Katra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Okay, so if you've ever tried to quickly sum up the Reformation, you probably land on 1517, right? Martin Luther, 95 Theses, boom, done.
Yeah, that's the standard shorthand. It's neat.
It is neat. But Peter Marshall's incredible book, The Reformation, shows us the reality was, well, infinitely messier and more violent and honestly, way more fascinating.
Absolutely. That's what we want to dig into today. Marshall's core idea that this wasn't some sudden flashpoint. It was a century-long process, a huge shift that didn't just, you know, split Christianity.
Right.
But it fundamentally reshaped everything in Europe, politics, society, even how people thought about themselves, their own minds.
So we're stepping away from that simpler story, the one where, you know, the reformers are the destined heroes and the Catholic Church was just this monolith of corruption. Exactly. Marshall forces us to look at the actual contested reality, the struggle, the debates, the violence.
The core question he tackles is just so relevant, even now, for understanding Western history.
It really is. How did this intense quest for religious truth get so tangled up with political power? How did that mix basically redraw the map of civilization and lay down these really complex roots for the modern world we inhabit? And tackling a story that huge, spanning a century, reshaping a continent, well, you need a really good guide.
Definitely.
And that's Peter Marshall. He's a professor of history at the University of Warwick, won the Wolfson History Prize. He's synthesized just an immense amount of material.
What grabs me about his approach is how intentionally he avoids that that traditional heroic narrative, what historians call Whig history.
Right. The idea that Protestantism was just this inevitable triumphant march towards, you know, progress and enlightenment.
He completely sets aside that kind of historical determinism.
He does. Marshall really insists on a balanced perspective. He points out the genuine spiritual energy and intellectual depth in late medieval Catholicism. It wasn't simply this broken institution waiting to fall.
But it doesn't pull punches on the other side either.
Not at all. He's equally clear about the deep divisions, the rise of state power over religion, and the, frankly, horrifying violence that often came with the Protestant movements. He gives you the full messy picture.
Okay, so let's lay out the big picture then. Marshall's argument. Reformation wasn't a quick event. It was a complex process lasting a century or more.
A process, yes. And it's all about how religious belief fundamentally rewired authority from kings and popes right down to your personal sense of identity and faith.
And it's not just Luther in Germany, right?
Yeah.
The scope is much broader.
Oh, absolutely. Marshall takes us all across Europe. We look at key figures like Zwingli in Zurich, Calvin in Geneva.
The radical Anabaptists, who are often suppressed.
Right, the revolutionaries. And crucially, he also covers the dynamic internal changes within Catholicism, the Counter-Reformation. It wasn't just reacting, it was evolving too.
The real insight here, I think, is seeing that intersection, where religious passion meets political maneuvering.
Exactly. The rise of nation states, grabbing church lands. It's this powerful, sometimes explosive mix. And Marshall argues that's what created the cultural landscape we still navigate today, ideas about faith, power, individual conscience.
So to really get why Luther's 95 Theses hit so hard, we need to understand the world before 1517.
Mm-hmm.
Marshall starts there, right? Challenging that simple image of late medieval Catholicism being just corrupt and dying.
He does. He shows it was actually a system full of vibrant religious life, though definitely troubled.
Vibrant but troubled. How so?
Well, the whole system basically revolved around what he terms the economy of salvation. Think of it like a spiritual accounting system. Salvation wasn't just given. You actively sought grace. Through mass, sacraments, going on pilgrimages, doing good works. And often, this involved money, like buying indulgences. It was the absolute center of life for most people.
But beneath that vibrancy, there were serious cracks. Marshall points to deep anxieties, right?
Huge anxieties. People were genuinely terrified about what happened after death, about purgatory. And alongside that, you had widespread anger at the clergy, anti-clericalism, resentment over wealth, perceived corruption.
Though the ground was fertile for change.
Precisely. Which brings us to the catalyst. Martin Luther and his massive theological idea, sola fide, justification by faith alone.
If salvation is a free gift from God, received only through faith.
Then that whole complex economy of salvation, the indulgences, the pilgrimages, the priest as the necessary middleman, it just collapses. The whole system is potentially unnecessary.
And then technology throws gasoline on the fire.
The printing press, absolutely critical. Luther's 95 Theses were supposed to be for an academic debate. in Latin.
But they get translated into German.
And printed and distributed with incredible speed. It's like the first viral phenomenon.
A media revolution, basically.
Totally. Print allowed Luther and others to completely bypass the traditional gatekeepers, the bishops, the universities, the Pope himself, and speak directly to ordinary people and, crucially, to the German princes.
It decentralizes information, spreads radical ideas almost instantly, turns a local dispute into a continental firestorm.
But here's the twist. Once that door to reform was kicked open, the reformers themselves couldn't agree where they were going.
Right. Marshall really emphasizes this immediate splintering. He calls it the diversities. Luther's way was just one path.
And almost immediately you get figures like Huldrych Zwingli in Zurich. His approach was different, more rationalist perhaps, trying to strip away anything in worship that wasn't explicitly found in the Bible.
And this disagreement wasn't minor. It led to a fundamental split over something central, the Eucharist, the communion.
Yes, at the Marburg Colloquy in 1529, this became a defining moment. Luther held on to the idea of Christ's real presence, that Christ was physically present in the bread and wine, a very traditional, sacred view.
But Zwingli saw it differently.
Completely. For Zwingli, it was symbolic, a memorial meal, a representation, not the actual presence. It sounds academic, maybe, but the implications were huge.
Because if it's just symbolic,
it drastically reduces the unique sacred power of the ordained priest. Why do you need them specifically? Marshall shows this single point created a permanent rift. Two Protestantisms, essentially, right from the start.
And then there are those even further out on the edge.
The Radical Reformation, the Anabaptists, they were challenging not just theology, but the whole structure of society.
They believed in adult baptism, not infant baptism, right?
Yeah.
And separation of church and state.
Exactly. Which was incredibly radical for the 16th century. They also often preached pacifism.
And they paid a heavy price for it.
Yeah.
Persecuted by everyone.
Mercilessly. By Catholics and by mainstream Protestants like Lutherans and Calvinists, because they refused to conform to the idea of a state-controlled church. This led to really explosive moments like the Minster Rebellion.
Ah, yes, 1534, where radical Anabaptists took over the city?
Yeah, established a sort of apocalyptic commune, abolished private property, introduced polygamy. It terrified the authorities because it wasn't just about belief anymore. It was challenging the fundamental political and social order.
Which brings us neatly to Marshall's big political point.
Yes. Ultimately, whether a particular reformation succeeded or failed often came down to one thing. The support of secular rulers.
The princes, the kings.
Exactly. Look at the German princes who backed Luther. They gained enormous political leverage, independence from the emperor and the pope, and not insignificantly, the right to seize vast amounts of church land and wealth.
This gets formalized in that famous phrase.
Quis regio, eis religio.
Whose realm, his religion. Basically, the ruler decides the religion of the territory.
Pretty much. Theology often ended up following political convenience or necessity.
And the ultimate example of that is England, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Marshall presents the English Reformation as the classic top-down Reformation. It wasn't initially driven by some great popular theological outcry.
It was driven by Henry VIII needing a divorce. His dynastic problems.
Precisely. Political need dictated religious change. And it created this unique sort of hybrid church, the Church of England, distinct from Rome, but also distinct from Geneva or Wittenberg. It perfectly shows how rulers' agendas shaped religious outcomes.
But while all this is happening in Northern Europe, Rome isn't just sitting there watching.
Not at all. And Marshall makes a really strong case here that the Catholic Counter-Reformation wasn't just a defensive reaction. It was also a genuine internal reform movement gaining steam.
So cleaning up his own house. Partly in response to the crisis.
Yes, clarifying its own identity, addressing long-standing issues like corruption, and they did this through some major institutional innovations.
Like the Council of Trent?
Crucial. Meeting on and off for almost 20 years, from 1545 to 1563. Trent definitively clarified Catholic doctrine, reaffirming the seven sacraments, the role of good works alongside faith. And it imposed strict disciplinary reforms on clergy. A massive undertaking.
And the other big innovation.
The Jesuits. Mm. The Society of Jesus, founded by Ignatius of Loyola, highly educated, incredibly disciplined, fiercely loyal to the Pope.
The shock troops of the Counter-Reformation, as they're sometimes called.
Right. Their focus on high-quality education, rigorous spiritual discipline, and global missionary work was incredibly effective. It allowed Catholicism to regroup, revitalize, and even expand its influence worldwide, despite the losses in Europe. So if we step back and look at Marshall's whole analysis, a few big themes really emerge.
Okay, let's pull those out.
First, the theme of unintended consequences. It's almost painfully ironic.
How so?
The reformers were driven by a desire for absolute religious certainty, for unity under what they saw as God's true word. But what they actually achieved was permanent religious division.
And eventually, that division made tolerance not a virtue, but a necessity.
Exactly. They inadvertently created the very religious pluralism they were trying to eliminate. It's a profound paradox.
That really does capture the era. What's another key theme?
The inextricable link between politics and religion. Marshall stresses that in this period, you simply couldn't separate them. They were, as he puts it, different aspects of the same reality.
Your political loyalty and your religious affiliation were bound together.
Completely. Being a good subject meant adhering to the ruler's religion. Political needs constantly shaped religious policy.
And a third major takeaway.
Marshall gives us this sense of historical continuity. He argues the Reformation wasn't some sudden bolt from the blue that just ended the Middle Ages.
Right. It wasn't a complete rupture.
No. Instead, he says it sort of revealed the tensions and possibilities that the Middle Ages had always contained. It grew out of existing anxieties about salvation, existing calls for reform. It was a culmination, not just a beginning.
Those are powerful ways to reframe such a huge historical moment. I like Marshall's phrase emphasizing agency, that the Reformation wasn't something that just happened to Europe.
Oh, yes.
It was something Europe made happen to itself.
That's such a key insight. It brings it back to human choices, doesn't it? Contingency. None of this was preordained. It was the result of countless decisions by real people, princes, theologians, ordinary folks grappling with genuine crises.
And let's circle back to that idea about freeing the church from the Pope, only to hand it over to the state.
That's a crucial dynamic, Marshall highlights. In trying to escape the distant authority of Rome, reformers often place the church under the much more immediate control of the local prince or king.
Creating a new kind of fusion between religious and political power.
Yes. And this often led not to more freedom, but to more intense social discipline enforced by the state in the name of religious purity. It's a pattern we see again and again in history. Movements aiming for liberation sometimes end up creating new, even stricter forms of control.
Okay, this is fascinating history, but let's bring it forward. What does this complex centuries-old story mean for us today? How can we apply these insights?
Well, the most striking parallel, I think, is the media revolution aspect. Marshall shows how the printing press let radical ideas bypass the old gatekeepers and spread like wildfire.
Sound familiar?
Exactly like the internet and social media today. We're living through a similar explosion of decentralized information. It leads to fragmentation, polarization, echo chambers.
Yeah, you see these niche ideological groups forming incredibly quickly online, sometimes around very radical ideas, much like the various Protestant sects did once print became widely available. The dynamic feels eerily similar.
It really does. The technology changes, but the human and social dynamics of information disruption seem constant.
What's another application?
I think the Catholic Counter-Reformation offers a powerful lesson in institutional adaptation. Think about Trent, the Jesuits.
Right, facing an existential crisis, massive criticism.
They didn't just collapse. They undertook serious internal reform. They clarified their core beliefs, addressed weaknesses, and found new ways to operate, like the Jesuit focus on education and global outreach. It's a case study in how established institutions can respond to crisis and criticism constructively without losing their essential identity. That's relevant for any organization facing challenges today.
That's a great point. So, reflecting on Marshall's work, what's your biggest personal takeaway?
For me, it's probably the profound importance of intellectual humility when looking at history and recognizing the power of those unintended consequences we talked about.
The reformers aiming for unity and getting division.
Exactly. It's a stark reminder that huge historical shifts rarely achieve exactly what their architects intended, and they almost always involve a complex mix of gains and losses. Nothing is ever simple progress or simple decline.
What about you? What surprised you or stood out most?
I think what really struck me is how the Reformation's true long-term significance might lie in something the reformers absolutely did not intend, laying the groundwork for modern ideas about individual conscience and religious pluralism, even though they were aiming for uniformity.
Right, by shattering the old certainties and forcing people and states to eventually grudgingly figure out how to coexist with religious difference, they inadvertently paved the way for concepts that are foundational to modern liberal societies. It's that deep irony again.
A powerful legacy born from conflict.
See you next time. with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.